there are times when all we can do is surrender to be present as best we're able with mind, heart. So we find ourselves where in part of life the Dhamma is taught to be in life. It's not like get out of life, but rather how to meet life with a kind of grace and a kind of onward leading attitude and holding of a center, holding of values, holding clear aspiration and manifesting our deepest intentions. So what else are we to do? What else are we to do? Who would we be? Would we be only our reactions? No matter how justified, is that all we would be? All these years of practice for many of you? Who would we be? Who do we want to be? So this is a very tense time for many reasons, and not just the election, but certainly including social justice, but also including the hurricanes in Louisiana, the fires in California and Colorado. There's all of these different reasons for it to be a challenging time. And we can so easily think that all the challenging time is for what we care about. But someone whose loved one is sick right now and may die, that's their focus. And that's appropriate. We can, without meaning to, really gain a kind of expectation, a demand really, that people should feel about what we feel about, be concerned about what we're concerned about. But that's not so. That's not so. We don't have a right to demand of another person. We have a right to communicate what we're concerned about, but not demand that someone else be concerned about that. This larger view allows us to ride the waves of up and down that happen, that we care and we let go. We care, we give our best, and then we let go. I've done what I could, and we let go. Many of you have heard me say or read when I write about T.S. Eliot and his teaching, teach us to care and not to care, teach us to sit still. There's so much lines. Teach us to care, that we easily get, and not to care. That's what the Buddha really captured so well. Teach us to care and not to care. Teach us to sit still. And again, that's what the Buddha taught so well, to be in the stillness of our caring hearts with perspective of the ever-changing world, and not to grab on the ever-changing world as defining us, even though it can really hurt sometimes. It can scare us. We can be scared for others. We can be scared for the future. And people can be scared for the future that have very different political views than you or you or you or me or them or they or her or him. It's held wide. It's held wide. It's not held narrowly. There's a clarity that we're living from, but it's not squeezing everybody else out. You know, tough, tough. The mindfulness is tied in, as I've said so many times, to the intention, and that produces the wisdom. But the compassion has to be there too, because the wisdom can become hard and cold and unyielding. It can fall into a kind of, I know I'm right, that leads one to kill for peace. And so we more than maybe members of a number of communities are equipped to meet difficult times because of our practice. And that's the invitation. This is a time to let the practice be at the center. Just as we are, not some superior version where we our very best moment on retreat. That's not who's going to meet all these moments. That's not very realistic. But you know, if we bring this attitude, this practice, our practice into this moment, we might surprise ourselves with some moments of freedom, some moments when there's not contraction, there's not grasping. So taking it as an opportunity for the practice, to ground in the practice as I was leading us in the meditation, that gives us a place to stand. It gives us a ground rather than our fluctuating feelings, our fluctuating views, our reactivity to things we think are outrageous, not fair, illegal. Just here now. This too is a moment of the Dhamma. For myself, I remember, I rehearse. So I imagine the more difficult moments that may come about and see if I can hold them in my imagination in Dhamma, so that I don't want to have a theory about practice. I want to have a lived experience. And all the moments right now are moments to practice for what could be larger moments of challenge over the next, you know, week till you're back together again. With that as a background, as a context, I would like to now just take questions or comments. And when I say about taking questions or comments, I don't mean about your political views. We don't want to bring our political views in here. What we want to do is bring our questions of practice in our circumstance. And so when you're taking questions, it might not be about anything that's likely to be occurring in the next week. It may be something, again, about you're dealing with someone you love that's in the process of dying, or it may be about your own disorientation because of not having a job. It doesn't. We're modeling right now the very point I've been making during this time we've been together. So I'm going to ask that, but before I do that, before we open it up, I did not double check to how much time I have. Do I have to 7:30 or what? How long do I have? 7:30, is that it? That's what I thought, okay. I've done so many things online now that if I don't write it down, I can't keep track of what any particular schedule is. So yes, if Bill, if you're handling this, opening it up so people can, and raise your hand. Let's see. Actually, maybe it's better if you raise your hand in chat. Is that, the participants box?
There is a hand raise facility, and I never remember how to do it because it's not available to co-hosts. There's a button that you can push that will give a little raised hand signal. One of the problems is that we have like three different screens here, so we can't possibly see everybody.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
Bill, would you want to, you want to call on people?
Scott or Joan Bengi. You're still muted.
Yes, I know. I've just got it off. Thank you. Hi, Philip.
Hi, it's nice to see the two of you.
Yeah, let's see if I can get rid of this little thing in the middle of the screen.
Yeah.
So this is, you've mentioned a couple of times, someone with a family member that may be dying, and you mentioned the wildfires, and Oregon was really hit by wildfires. And just this last week, I've been through quite our family with my mother being in the hospital and, you know, not being able to get her to thrive again. And she had to have a minor surgery, but it just seems to really, and now we found out she has cancer, but it's still, and then I drove home through where towns were wiped out along the Mackenzie River where I grew up. And each time I went past a burnt down house with this chimney sitting there, I just felt like a stab in my heart. But I'm so grateful for this practice. And I'm grateful for this Sangha too, because we came, it was just last week, was it, with Sally, and she gave that day long with compassion. So I would say the phrases, you know, as I was going along, and I just did so much of that on the way home. But when I got home, I was really tired, and I'd been with my mom in and out of the I'd been in and out of the hospital. She'd been in the hospital for 4 days, and through this process, and I was really tired. And I know that I don't know that if practicing compassion in that way, or being in the sorrow, is tired. You know, I know emotional things are tiring, but is there a way to work with that, or a way to, I guess it's just acknowledge it. I just acknowledged that I was tired, really tired, but not fall into the, you know, the far enemy or the near enemy, or, you know, the pity and stuff like that. So I don't know if you have any words about working with compassion when times are difficult. I mean, that's on top of everything else that's going on in the world, but yeah.
I hear so much now about people being tired, so yeah. Much. They just over and over again, they will, and you could call it compassion fatigue, but I think that's a little too labely. It's a very difficult time. And so it is natural that at times in the course of a day or a week, we're going to get really tired from this. And then at that moment, it is turning towards self-compassion, because if we exhaust ourselves, burn ourselves out, we are not doing anyone any good by that. And that's a kind of compulsion of caring. And that was not what the Buddha was teaching, but rather a natural arising. And it's a tough time. And again, I was doing this personally. I did not know about your situation, but I knew somebody on this call would be in that situation. And maybe many of you. And so you can, like, when you passed each house, sometimes it's each house is too exhausting, so you hold the whole valley with compassion. And other times you just do a line, or you just do one word, Or you do a mantra like this too, in which you mean that your heart's willing to be available to this aspect of life too. These opposites that you're willing to, that you don't have to deny it, but you don't have to go. You don't have to go towards more than is that arises naturally. So you're available to knowing the truth of the dukkha of the realm. You're feeling the dukkha and your heart, because it's happening to each person. And so you feel that, you know, but you don't have to like go over to it. You stay grounded and therefore available to life. If we go, as I said this during the meditation, if we get all over something, we can't then support it because we're all over it. So in our own way, we're pushing and pulling at it or having some sort of reacting to it. No, we just support it. We will hold it. So that makes sense. And I mean this practically. I'm not being philosophical at all, but practical.
Yes. Yeah, I think simplifying is helpful. Thank you.
Most welcome. Good to see you both, as I said before. It's been a long time now. Lucia.
Lucia, you're muted.
There we are. It's good to see you, Philip. It's great to
see
you,
and thank you for your letter. That was very
enjoyable. Oh, you're quite welcome. That's sweet, yes. So I want to empathize with Joan about the fatigue. I feel, some people call it COVID fatigue. You know, some people call it sheltering in place fatigue. But I understand that fatigue. It's draining. I feel kind of wrung out, as they say. And one of the things that has happened in my life is that last Sunday, our dog, little Cody, crossed over the bridge to join her friends who had gone before her. And that was really tough for us. So we're not only struggling with the fatigue from COVID, but also her passing. And it's been a time of real reflection. And I go back and reflect on the years and the decades past, but I also have to reflect on how am I doing now? I don't want to get hard. I don't want to get tough. I don't want to get, just get over it kind of attitude, because it's not something you just get over, something that you live with. And so Joan, just take care of yourself and love yourself. It's not easy. I understand that. And I think we're all going through something very similar with the fatigue of having to deal with the immediate COVID crisis and our own issues around not being able to get out and be with friends and family like we used to. And it will pass, but right now it's pretty tough. It's pretty tough. So, but thank you, Philip, so much. Where are you? There you are. No, Art. I see Art. There you are, Philip. Thank you so much for taking all this opportunity. It's great to see you. And I appreciate your talk tonight. So And I love all of you all. It's good to see everybody. Thank you.
Two points coming out of Lucia's comments. One is that it's not every caring is not caring about large things and caring about the immediate and the personal are there's room for all of that. One's not supposed to stop caring about the passing of one's dog because one's concerned about the world. It's a continuum of response. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. And then the second thing is that, as I've told many people in the last months, there's a kind of wrinkle that has happened in the psyche of our culture. And we're all affected by that wrinkle, even if we're having actually a personal, really good time, that we're happy right now in our personal lives and what's unfolding for us personally. There's this wrinkle that has happened. You could call it a tear or something more dramatic, but I prefer just that there's a wrinkle where it's all, things are all helter-skelter in a certain way around in our cultural psyche. And that is very tiring as well. And then the last thing, without any way say anything more, I would ask, as you know, just like I do in person, I don't know how you all have been doing this, but I'd rather you not address each other, but just address it towards me, because we never know how our interaction can be heard by another member of the Sangha. So best to do that, if you all don't mind that. I don't know how you've been doing. So someone else. Yes.
Steve had his hand up a minute ago.
Oh, sorry, Steve. I have to look for you.
Oh, there he is. Okay, Steve.
Right here. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak here this evening. Philip, I wanted to ask you about another kind of overwhelm that is happening to me personally, and not only to me, but to others as well. I'm not working right now, but when I was constantly being asked to do everything I could to multitask, to do more, learn more software, be involved in more doing. And you were just talking about our cultural psyche, and I've seen this sort of trend, you know, possibly tied into our consumerist tendencies as a society, our need to want more, our need to do more. And so in this moment, there are so many things that are causing people stress. But as this moment passes, I fear, and I hear people saying, I want it to go back to the way it used to be. Well, the way that it used to be was so overwhelming for me, and it was just becoming even more so. And if I'm making any sense, I'm just wondering if there's something that you can say to address that kind of overwhelm of just not being enough, not having enough, just having to do more and more and more and keep up with each other, keep up with other cultures. It's overwhelming, and it just put me in a place where I kind of fell apart.
I can feel that. Sorry that you've had to go through that. Last night, I'm not quite sure what time. I think around 9:30. It could have been a little later, but I went for a walk in the full moon in the little town I live in. and I walked through neighborhoods and then into there's only sort of 1.5 streets of the little town where I live. And it was empty. So there was maybe 10 other people walking their dogs or leaving a party or something that were out. And the little town was so friendly, so warm, so inviting. Like, oh, it was a feeling of, oh, I would love to live here. And because I had a flashlight, but never needed it. And the thought that was with me around that is that we live in a particular time under certain conditions, just as you were describing, Steve, just as you were describing. And this particular time and these particular conditions aren't particularly friendly in many ways because they're too much involved in doing, getting, you know, judging yourself, comparing yourself, this sense of a cultural expectation that was our momentum. And then this wave of the pandemic and came through and created this large wrinkle. And then I think that large wrinkle is what allowed the social justice to finally get awake in this country in a certain way. Will we go back to the country we were? In some way, it's not possible because of too many things have happened, and it's never the same anyway. That's what we learned from Nietzsche. But the real opportunity is what you do, and each of us do, so that you don't become part of that fixation, for lack of a better word. You don't succumb to those urges that you feel around you that it feels natural to get in step with, but you have choice around that. And the Dhamma can be part of what allows you to create enough space from the cultural compulsions to have choice. So that's what I would say to you. And picture yourself now that you don't want to go back, that you want to go forward. You don't know quite what forward is, but you're really available to forward. And giving yourself these weeks and months that lie ahead of us in this to really say, well, what forward might be? Oh, well, I would live more simply, or the kind of job I would have, or whatever it would be, just your speech or anything to your diet, to the exercise, to what you read. So it'd be a matter of giving things up, adding things, cultivating a certain attitude that you wish to maintain, craft your practice in a certain way so that you're very clear you're not going back. You're going on. You're going to be available for something new to emerge as the experience of your life and however much time, you know, any of us have left. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, thank you.
And I'm quite serious about this. And I deliberately said it, however much time we have left. If one good use of, one does not, I've said this to organizations and it's had various effects on various organizations. One should never waste a crisis because you pay the price for whatever the crisis is. And so you're going to pay it anyway. You know, our culture is like it is. The jobs that have been lost, the people that are in danger of losing their homes, all of these things are like they are. That's already happened and will happen to varying degrees going forward. But within that crisis, there creates this opportunity. Well, amidst all of this, what do I choose? And with organizations, that's what I say to organizations. You're shut down. So use this time of being shut down to reflect, to change things. If it's a physical structure, build something new. If it's your organization, redo the organization. If there's a difficulty between two of your leaders, then work it out because you're stuck anyway. You're shut down to some degree or completely. utilize the time of this, because you're already paying the cost of being shut down. And I'd say that to you as a person and to all of us. And I certainly say this to myself, like, really take advantage of this, because I too am feeling everything that others are feeling. So I don't want to just feel it and like I'm just trudging through. I deliberately cultivate this attitude of, okay, what's to be done with this? I hope I'm not sounding a little preachy tonight. I'm really wanting you to. I came here clearly with I wanted to give kind of honest, revealing testimony. So I hope it's not sounding preachy.
No, it's appreciated. Thank you, Philip.
You're most welcome. Bill, you're...
Vita was next. Vita, you're still muted.
Thank you, Philip. Always such a privilege and a treat to see you and hear you, as you know. So the way things are in my personal life, I don't know if you know that my daughter and daughter-in-law had this traumatic accident January of last year where they were walking and got hit by a car.
I do know that.
I'm just not sure, of course you remember. It feels almost like it's gotten, they were healing. The brain damage seems to have accelerated. My daughter-in-law is having seizures now. My daughter's brain injuries are. So obviously when I'm with them, most of the time, life is what it is. They'll do the best they can. We'll do the best we can. I love them. But sometimes my heart just hurts so much. It just, and the Dharma's been helpful, obviously. Practice, as weak as it is, has been very helpful. But sometimes it's just hurts. I don't know what to do when it gets to that. I try to sit with it. I try to allow it. I try to just not push it away. I've had a good teacher. But sometimes it's overwhelming.
Yeah, I'm really sorry. And I think of this in terms of the other large emotional experience like this you went through. So here again, you know, how many can you take? I really understand and feel that. I don't have any like great pearl of wisdom because we're not trying to avoid how much it hurts. So we're not denying how much it hurts. I'm going to give you three little pieces of orientation here. The first is when your heart is breaking, it is actually true, it's something of a cliche now, but it is actually true that if we stay with it in a certain way, it breaks our heart open.
That's right.
And I can feel in your grief and even the exhaustion of your grief, that also is part of what's happening. So we can orient towards letting it break us open, rather than thinking we're supposed to stand against it so hard. Mm-hmm. And there's a mundane version of that, and then there's a mysterious version. And I am deciding these months whether or not I must talk more about the mysterious version of it. But I know you well enough to say that to you. And so that's the first piece of advice is that way, that in terms of meeting life when life is really doing this. The second is the idea of surrendering beyond what you think you can surrender. Yeah. And I'm not going to say more about that. That's to be explored.
Thank you.
And then the third is that we have it's amazing how much, despite all the evidence in the world, that we think this life is supposed to be other than this intermingle of the duality. It's amazing how much we persist in this, that we think something's wrong when it's awful. But this realm is full of the awful, just like it's full of wonderful. But it's we just somehow can't let loose of this idea that it's supposed to be, if something's wrong, it's unfair, it's I've done something wrong, somebody's done something wrong, why is there this awful? But this is the nature of the realm. And this is what the Buddha was saying when he was saying, it's just good enough for us to feel okay and be available for Dhamma, but it's also bad enough so that we feel the suffering. And so to look at that and say, oh, this is what he means, you know, that this is the truth of seeing the Dhamma. Ugh, can I hold up under this? Can I bear, you know, can I bear to feel the truth of this? And the surrender helps, and the other two I just talked about, that broken heart openness, that helps with being able to bear this. And again, what might be the fruit of that? Well, we think of enlightenment and we think of kind of endless compassion, but the fruit of all of these might be something a little more spacious, a little more the freedom might be different than we think, that the freedom might be arising in the tension. The freedom's right there. So it's not somewhere around that tension of the opposites of this, of your daughter-in-law and being healthy or being really, you know, really getting worse. But right there in that somewhere is, if it's both embraced, then our role in it switches from the ego's perspective. It switches somehow. Again, pointing back to this mysterious nature of it. So that we, you know, when I quoted Eliot to all of you so many times, the way out is the way through. Right straight through that dukkha. That's something that so I talk about it being an ennobling truth. And I, again, if I'd had the courage, I would have called it the four ennobling truths. It is ennobling in the here and now of it, in that immediacy that I was pointing to at the beginning of the, that it's like right here. And what's that? And, you know, we're our regular old ego self and all of this. And then, oh, there's this too. And more as the pain can actually help us be with the this too, in some way that opens to someplace not quite what's imagined. And not Pollyannish, but it's a different relationship.
Thank you, Philip. It always helps to hear you. You're there for my goods and my bads.
So, Jim, you were next. Jim, you're muted.
Thank you. Thank you, Philip, for everything. Well, I'm attempting to teach some high school teenagers online. Need I say anything else? They're really, it's just, they're really stuck. You know, we're all stuck. It's really getting progressively much worse, to the point where my recommendation is we stop the program, because it's just, they're becoming so, catatonic. comes to mind as one synonym. It's just too, they're dropping out, they're flunking out. But I need this class to graduate. That's the mantra. But it's incredibly frustrating to them and to me. I've tried a little bit of meta practice and, you know, to help them, but it's just, I don't know what else to do. It's just, it's very, it takes me hours to recover every day. And I lay awake at night trying to figure out another way to approach it. But it's just.
How many do you have in one class?
Not that many because, 10, 15.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, first of all, I've heard this numerous times. There's sure. certainly exceptions, but I've heard this numerous times and lots of people have very strong feelings about all sorts of things about this, which we don't want to get into those different views. I have my own views, but I don't get into those. One thing I would, I've had the privilege, although it doesn't necessarily feel good at times, but of getting to work with some young people for various reasons. Some of my life balance clients have sent various of their children to me over the years. More in college than high school, but a few in high school. But one thing I would ask you about is there a way that you could make them the teachers of each other more?
I've tried that. I send them to breakout rooms. Well, let me give you one more caveat. I have never seen any of their faces. This is another phenomenon. They do not turn the cameras on. We're not allowed to mandate that because of privacy. And it's gone further than that. Most of them won't even speak.
Wow. So
it's that tells you, I mean, again, the isolation.
I did not know that.
I put them in breakout rooms and I've asked them, like, do you turn your cameras on for each other? No.
Wow.
Howie Cohn described it once as he was trying to help his daughter with this Canvas program, which is what the academia has used. And he said it was almost unbearable. I said, yeah, Howie, it is unbearable. Yeah.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear this. It could be that all you're going to do is that you're going to model caring.
Mm-hmm. And best then, I can do. Yeah.
And then make little short more metaphorical, show them little short videos, mm-hmm, whatever, mm-hmm, make it much more entertaining, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm, then just accept this is all I can do.
Yes.
And that my caring, they will remember that, some of them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We're doing a lot of damage to young people, and that's just, there's no denying it.
Yes.
And that's so again, there's, I would put that among one of the big things we're doing, but others wouldn't. Mm-hmm. They'd say, oh, no, this other's the only thing that's big and so forth. Everybody's got our own view about this.
Yeah,
but
you're
there at the line and do what you can and tell them you care.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
you know, that's mm-hmm. all I could suggest.
Thank
and
you.
For you to really, at the end of your, you do like a Harvard that you do, just at the end of the time, brush yourself mm-hmm. off. Wash mm-hmm. your hands, go outside, mm-hmm. and regain your own center.
Yeah, I do a sitting, et cetera. Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
That's important, because otherwise mm-hmm. there's no sustainability.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
All right, Jerome has his hand up.
Hi. Hi, Philip.
Hi, Jerome.
It's been a while since I've seen you. I was on your previous time that you were with Marin Horizon during this period. My question is along the lines of what Vito was talking about. One of my Sangha members who I love very much had a very serious bike accident in April, and he was hospitalized at Marin General and then at St. Mary's for rehabilitation. And then he went to a brain injury hospital in Bakersfield and returned home just a few weeks ago. And I've been visiting him at least once a week since he got back. And last week we had a nice walk in his neighborhood. And I was talking to him about accepting how he is right now, that it's going to take at least till next April, as the doctors have said, for him to really regain all of his cognitive abilities. And that it was important for him to recognize that and allow it to be. And so the question I have is, I know he's still cognitively impaired because I have I visited with him on Thursday, no, Wednesday, and he just repeated himself a couple of times, well, at least once, asked the same question of me that he had previously asked of me. So I'm just wondering if you have any advice on to as to how I can help him regain his cognitive abilities through the practice or otherwise. Thank you so much for your talk, by the way. I loved it.
Well, I'm not qualified to talk about dealing with a brain injury that way. I would not, but and I've in my time had a number of people that repeated questions over and over again. And sometimes I've worked with people that would like finish telling me a story and then start the story over. And then again, start the story over and go through the whole thing using all the same words and just, and like with no sense of any of that having happened. And I I'm not trained to do anything, but what I didn't try to make them self-conscious about that. I dealt with moving their interest to things. And I would just have you stimulate him the way the brain responds to stimulation. So I would just have you stimulate and make sure that you too aren't like, you're holding the possibility of his brain coming back, but you're not demanding that his brain come back, that you're not setting up some sense of possible defeat that were frustration. And you just be stimulating, find out what, just observe what stimulates him and respond that way. And it may be weeks before you could even have one hint as what stimulates him. In the meantime, you just keep hanging out with him and holding that way. And you're holding the possibility for him to recover, but you're not, there's not a demand in that holding the possibility, if you understand what I mean.
I definitely do. Yeah, I know. I know with my own son, when he had cancer in 1976, I didn't hold any kind of possibility that he would survive. And yet, by some hand of God or something, he really did survive. And he's a wonderful young man now.
Well, so yeah, you're holding possibility, but you're not demanding. That's different. So you treat him as someone who's still growing, who's still active, and you just assume it, but you don't demand it. So you're at the edge of stimulating him just to his next step, not some 10 steps down the line. Right now, just this step, whatever he's responsive to, you're alive and awake in real time with him.
Yes, that's good. Thank you.
So I'm aware of the time, and do we have any closing? I'm supposed to stop right like 5 minutes ago, right? Okay. See, some things don't change. So let's do loving kindness together, and then we'll stop, and then everybody can unmute, and Bill, you can unmute everybody, but not yet, and then we can say our goodbyes together. So loving kindness, and then I will do the dedication of the merit. And for those of you who are new, I will say one of the four lines of the metta, and then you would say it out loud if you can, or silently if you've got others around you. And when you're saying it, you're offering the loving kindness, this friendliness, this caring friendliness to others. But in that ensuing silence, you're receiving it, and you can definitely receive it even in electronic form. May you be safe from internal and external harm. May you have a calm, clear mind and a peaceful, loving heart. May you be physically strong, healthy, and vital. May you experience love, joy, wonder, and liberating wisdom in this life, just as it is. May our practice this evening be a benefit in our own lives and be a benefit to all of those that we come in contact with. May it allow us to be a better friend, parent, child, all of the different roles we play. Any merit that arises from our practice this evening, we offer that merit to the benefit of all beings, without demand, without preference, without discrimination. May all beings in some way, small or large, be a benefit from the sincerity and the honesty of our practice.
Sorry.